Hello and welcome to another edition of Popcorn Optional, a weekly movie podcast where we talk all things movies, everything you like, things you don't like, but all sorts of fun stuff. My name is Cameron Salina, and this week I am joined by my co-host Trevor Allison. How are we doing, bud?
Hey, oh, good. It's good to be back.
Good to be back. Good to have you back. This week we are not joined by Jake, but I can promise you that he will be back next week as we review either Stranger Things Season 2 or Thank You for Your Service and do double dipping in Miles Teller Land. I think it just kind of depends on how fastly we can binge watch Stranger Things Season 2. But that being said, Stranger Things Season 1 was what we talked about last week, and since Trevor wasn't here, Trevor, I understand you have some things you would like to say.
Yeah, just real quick about Stranger Things. I listened to you guys talking about it the other day. I'm kind of sad that I missed that on that conversation. But of course, I love Stranger Things. The thing that sticks out to me when I think about Stranger Things is the universal appeal of it. I don't know anyone who watched an episode and was like, I couldn't get into it. Like, everyone that I've talked to, like, as far-reaching as, like, my little sister, the, like, middle schoolers that I work with at church, my aunt and uncle were raving about it, like, a week after it came out. I mean, who are not, like, normally up with it on culture. So, I mean, this is a universal appeal. Everyone loves it. As far as season two, I'm a little bit of a curmudgeon and don't think that it needs to exist
at all.
I would have been fine with it as maybe an anthology series in the same world or universe. I don't think this needs to exist, but I am super excited about it at the same time. So if the Duffer Brothers had just said, all right, we're going to go in a different direction, we're going to leave this as it is, and it was great, I'd be like, all right, sure, respect that. It's so good. But they did such a great job with it, and I think that there's a lot of buy-in with the actors and everyone that's involved with the production team. I think it's going to be good, but I am a little nervous about sometimes we get things that are stretched a little bit further than they should be.
Have you, because early reviews have come out, and there are people out there who, in the press and industry, who have seen the entire season. Have you looked at any of the reviews so far?
I have not. I haven't even seen the trailers. I intentionally avoided them.
Okay, then I will save that and not say anything. If you are interested, you can go on Rotten Tomatoes and check out the score that this show has so far and check out little micro reviews that'll take you to longer reviews. Or you could even pretty much just type in Stranger Things Season 2 reviews, and I guarantee you will find it on tons of press blogs and tons of other things where people have been able to see it early. And you know, that would be nice to be able to do that, but, you know, it's not reality right now, so that's okay. Moving on, though, there's only one piece of news this week, and it may be the most shocking news of the year in terms of, I would be willing to bet that even if you gave me, you know, 100 to 1 odds on this pairing, I would have still bet against it happening. Because Dora the Explorer is being made into a live-action movie. That's not the shocking part. The person
that's not a surprise at all.
That's not a surprise at all. It's a very popular series. It ran for close to, I think, 10 years and hundreds of episodes. The shocking thing is who's producing it. Michael Bay of Transformers and Ninja Turtles and any explosion you've ever seen in a movie. So I mean,
Dora is about to get a lot sweatier, right?
Unfortunately, if it's Michael Bay, that's just the unfortunate way of how women are in his movies. And
right. I guess my main question is, like, what is his level of involvement going to be? I know that producer can mean a lot of different things.
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, like that, even though it's not directed by him, that very much feels like his kind of movie.
Right, you're right. So, but this isn't even like in the realm of things that he does. Like, I don't even understand. I don't understand.
I just can't picture like the TV show, but Michael Bade. I honestly was shocked out of my mind when I heard this. It felt like a joke to the point where like,
what I can think of is like Lara Croft Tomb Raider.
Yeah.
Is that like what is that what a Michael Bay Dora the Explorer looks like?
That's exactly what I was thinking, was that they're just going to make this is their way of being like, hey, we're making a Dora the Explorer movie. And I bet you if anything, it's called like Dora or like something simple like that. That's just like, I seriously doubt it's called Dora the Explorer. I would be willing to place $10 on the table right now that it's not called Dora the Explorer.
Oh, I would be willing to bet $10 that there's going to be a colon in its title.
Dora the Explorer, the first explorer.
It's or like Dora Beyond the Jungle.
Ooh. You know,
like something like that.
Okay. Okay. That's fair. I'll give you that. I'm going to stick by my fact that I think that it's going to be called Dora.
Okay.
And the poster will be her, like, the back of her, like, of her backpack with her monkey sitting on the backpack and just, like, her kind of, like, looking over her shoulder in, like, the jungle. I would be willing to place an infinite amount of money that that's the poster.
I mean, of course it is.
It's ridiculous. I think we've spent 3 minutes talking about this, and that's about as much time as I want to give talking
agree.
About it. So
agree.
I think if anything, it's more of a statement as to where the industry is right now, and that's just.
Wait, I have a question for you.
Okay.
If you had to say right now, what's going to make more money, Dora the Explorer, or the Joker origin story? Which is it?
Dora the Explorer, like hands down. Well, it depends. It really depends. I think it depends on who is in the Joker movie.
Okay.
And who ends up... Are we talking about the Harley Quinn Joker movie or like the Scorsese-produced
Joker the movie? Scorsese, Todd, what's his face from The Hangover one?
Yeah, Todd Phillips. If they get Leo... Nardo DiCaprio. I would put money on the Joker. What would you do?
Okay. I think Dora, just because people take their little girls to movies.
Not if it's Tomb Raider.
I guess that depends on the marketing.
Yeah. I can't picture like a Michael Bay. Well, I guess there was, like, in the newest Transformers, there's that little girl who's Mark Wahlberg's sidekick or apprentice, whatever you would like to call her, and Bumblebee. Uh-huh. I guess there's that, but it doesn't feel very Michael Bay-esque.
I think best case scenario here is we get something with, like, the feel of Spy Kids.
Oh, best case scenario. I love Spy Kids. Maybe that's just, you know, it came out when I was that age and that was part of the culture of that time, but
it's definitely ridiculous, but it has some merit.
Yes. I think Robert Rodriguez fully knew what kind of movie he was making, and I think that only makes it better.
Yeah, I agree.
It's definitely a guilty pleasure. But we've now spent almost 5 minutes talking, and that's just way too long. Way too long. Let's stop. But we're going to get to a new segment. And this is going to be a interesting one because we're going to have to kind of replay this. Not replay it, but we're going to have to kind of review it come December. And what this segment is do we have a name for this? Either we just call it Rotten Tomatoes. Guess that tomato. Is the tomato ripe?
Is the tomato ripe? I like that.
How ripe is the tomato? Let's call it that. How ripe is the tomato? I'm going to write that down right now so I don't forget it. So what this segment is where we are going to guess the Rotten Tomato scores for movies coming out in the month of November. As far as the movies go, it's whatever the score is at the end of the first weekend that it's out. So come Monday morning, what is that score? Because some reviews come in over the weekend. I think it's fair to, you know, give it the weekend as far as timing goes. Now, that being said, the way it's going to work is over the course of a month, we're going to keep track of mine and Trevor's scores. And if Jake wants to, we can keep track of his scores as well. He can get in on this. But the way it works is you get 1 point for whoever's closest to it. If you happen to be right on and guess the direct exact number, you get 5 points. So that's kind of a, you know, big deal. If you get it right on, you're going to get a huge lead. And at the end of the month, what's going to happen is the winner will have veto power to pick whatever movie they want for the podcast to review. And they have power to say, you know, we'll pick a weekend, and whenever, if we have options, that person gets to pick whatever they want. So let's say, you know, there's a weekend that comes up where it's a lull and I'm like, hey, we're going to review Avatar this weekend because I think it'd be funny. And I'm going to make Jake and Trevor watch Avatar again. So that's how it's going to work. 5 points for right on, 1 point for closest to it. We're each going to guess what we think Rotten Tomatoes is, keep track of it over the month. We'll get back to you guys in December with how it tallied out. So, first movie of November, Thor Ragnarok. Trevor, what do you think this is going to weigh in at?
All right, I think I'm going to give this I'm going to say 92. I think it's going to be, kind of on the heavier end of the Marvel movies. I mean, I don't know if we've done this, but I'm guessing that no Marvel movie in the last few years has been below 80 or 85 anyway.
Ant-Man, I think, is the only one.
What?
I think Ant-Man's the only one.
Oh, okay. And that's not bad.
I think Ant-Man's like 70-something.
Okay. Yeah, so I'm going to say a 92 on this. Okay. The we know each other from work line is worth at least 50. That's like the baseline.
Okay, I'll give you that. Okay, I'm gonna do the smart thing here, and I'm gonna go with a 93. So I'm gonna go over you by one, because all I think that this film is going to be a hit critically. But if I was to place another bet on this, I would say that this film. Well, no, the box office numbers have been pretty decent. I was going to say, I don't think this movie will be as big of a financial success as other Marvel movies have due to things that I've heard as far as the tone of the movie, but I think that it'll be a critical hit. So, Thor Ragnarok, Trevor's at 92, I'm at 93. I'll go first this time just to keep things fair, and that way if you want to cap me on one side or the other, you can do that as well.
Sure.
The next film, okay, so we should say Thor Ragnarok coming out November 3rd. The next film is Murder on the Orient Express. I think this movie is going to be better than people think it is based on the trailers, but I don't think it's going to be great. And so I'm going to give it a 75.
All right. And I'm going to just keep this number because it's close enough to yours. I think it's going to be a 78. I think I agree with it being better than people think it is. It's a classic story. It's Kenneth Branagh. I mean, I know it's not quite the Shakespeare stuff he usually does, but period pieces are Kenneth Branagh's wheelhouse. I think he's going to be great as Poirot. So I'm optimistic about this.
Murder on the Orient Express comes out November 10th. Also coming out November 10th is Daddy's Home, the new film starring Will... Daddy's Home 2, I should say. The
yes,
new
they
film
made a sequel.
And sequel. And to the original Daddy's Home, because everybody was asking for that. This time, along with Will Ferrell and Mark Wahlberg, are starring their dads, or movie dads, Mel Gibson and John Lithgow. So, Trevor, what did you say you think Murder on the Orient Express is going to get?
I said 78 on Murder on the Orient Express.
Okay, that's fair. Okay, Daddy's Home 2.
Okay, Daddy's Home 2... I'm going to say 21. I think it's going to be bad, but funny enough to not get in those like single digits or teens. There's definitely going to be one of those micro reviews, which I love, where someone says, why does this exist? Those are my favorite micro reviews.
Yeah. I like those. I'm going to stick with the number that I have written down, and that's a 25.
Okay.
But at the same time, I would be willing to bet that I think that this movie could get a 10. I think this could right. also just be a complete bomb. I think the first one was actually like decently received. Like it wasn't great, but it wasn't terrible. I think if I remember right, hold on, I'm gonna pull it up really quick. Oh, no, wait, never mind. The first one was a 31. Okay, so the first one didn't do great either. But I'm going to be at 25. Trevor's going to be at 21. That's Daddy's Home 2 coming out November 10th. Moving on to the next weekend, we have Justice League, which is the DC film starring Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, Cyborg, Flash, Aquaman, every single DC superhero you can think of. I think it's my turn. Okay. I would be willing to place money on the table that this is on the positive side of Rotten Tomatoes. Now, to be on a positive side, you need to be a 60 or above. That being said, I'm going to stick with my number, and I think this is going to be an 80.
Oh,
I'm going to go
high.
I'm going to go high.
Wow. Wow.
I'm going to go high.
All right.
Do you think that's way too high? I mean, tell me, where are you at?
I do. I think it's way too high. I think it's going to be somewhere in between, like, Man of Steel and Batman v Superman. I have it. I think I'm going to say, like, a 48.
Ooh.
I think it's going to be bad, but I think it's going to have enough spectacle to pull itself up a little bit.
Okay.
But yeah, I'm not optimistic. I am excited to see it, but I'm not optimistic.
I'm optimistic. I think with Joss Whedon coming in, I think with Gal Gadot, this could be a good film. I mean, Wonder Woman was, you know, a 95 or something, and I hope that with the reshoots... Now, okay, so here's what I should say. One of two things is going to happen. Either Joss Whedon was able to come in and reshoot a bunch of things and kind of tweak things up. Or this movie feels like two completely different films and it's just garbage. I'm on the optimistic side. I'm going to say 80. I'm going to stick with it.
All right.
Justice League comes out Friday, November 17th. Also coming out that weekend is a film based on a book adaptation starring Jacob Tremblay, Julia Roberts, and Owen Wilson. It's called Wonder, and it's based on a book. It's directed by Steven Shablosky, who directed Perks of Being a Wallflower and also wrote Perks of Being a Wallflower. And it looks incredibly moving and emotional. So, Trevor, where are you at on Wonder?
I'm going to give this a 75. I think it's going to be good and sweet, but not great.
Okay, that's fair. I'm pretty high on this movie. I loved Perks of Being a Wallflower, and I think that is probably known by people that, you know, listen to this podcast. I've talked about it on several occasions of how much I love it. And I think with the addition of Tremblay, I think this could be a big deal. So I'm going to go with a 91.
Okay.
Trevor, did you say you were 75?
Yeah, 75.
75. Alrighty. So that is Wonder coming out on November 17th up against Justice League. November 22nd, the week of Thanksgiving, is Pixar's newest film, Coco. And I don't know if this is cheating or not, I've heard very, very positive things about this movie. Very positive. Very, 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 very positive. And based on Pixar's track record, I think this film is going to be a huge hit. And I'm going to say this film is at a 98.
A 98?
98.
Oh, my.
Yeah. I'm swinging for the fences here.
I'm going to say, I mean, of course, it's a Pixar film. It looks like it's going to be somewhere in between Up and Inside Out with a little bit of Book of Life mixed in, which I know isn't a Pixar movie. But, yeah, I think it's going to be very good. I think it's going to be a 91.
91? Ooh.
91.
Okay. That gives me very little wiggle room. I didn't realize how thin I would be on that space at a 98.
I think it's going to be very good. I think there's going to be maybe a little something missing. This is just me. I don't know. I think it looks like a fun original idea, though. I could very well be wrong. But it just doesn't quite feel like it's going to be as heavy hitting as some of those top Pixar films.
Kind of with you, but I think this is going to be a big deal. That is Coco coming out November 22nd, which is a Wednesday, but that is how things normally work out on the Thanksgiving weekend. So that is our Rotten Tomatoes for the month. We should mention there are plenty of other fantastic movies that come out that month where you just, you know, these are the ones we picked. There's things like A Bad Mom's Christmas, Wonderstruck, Killing of a Sacred Deer, Last Flying Flag, Lady Bird, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, Mudbound, Darkest Hour. There are plenty of other huge films and big box or big Oscar contenders that are coming out. These are just kind of the seven that we picked that we thought would be fun to do for this. But yeah, so those are our reviews. Those are how ripe we think the tomato will be. And we will come back the first weekend of December as to the results of this wager. That's all we have for that for now, though. And we're going to go ahead and get on to trailers, because this week dropped the brand new trailer for Paul Thomas Anderson's newest film and also the final Daniel Day-Lewis film. And the movie's called Phantom Thread, and it's about a dressmaker and fashion designer, I think in the like 1950s era, and kind of about his life and love life and everything that that entails. So Trevor, what was your reaction to this trailer?
My reaction is that I'm all basically only interested in this movie because it's PTA and Daniel Day-Lewis. It looks kind of, I'm not really sure what it's about. I'm not sure why it's interesting. I know that PTA's movies are always interesting, even if they're not great. So it's going to be interesting, but I don't know where that's going to come from. It does have a little bit of a vibe where it could get real weird at some point, though.
Yeah, there are parts of this trailer that are very weird, which isn't surprising from a PTA standpoint. His movies are always kind of very weird. I mean, some of the PTA films that are, you know, most popular, you know, Boogie Nights, Magnolia is very, very weird. There Will Be Blood, Punch Drunk Love, The Master. What was that new Inherent Vice?
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, his films are always very, very interesting, whether they're well-received or not. They're interesting, I will say that. But the last time that Daniel Day-Lewis and Paul Thomas Anderson worked together was on There Will Be Blood, which in many people's opinions is one of the top five best films since in the 21st century so far. And it also got Daniel Day-Lewis an Oscar, one of his three. So I think people are pretty hyped about this, but I'm with you. I think if you had a different director, or if I didn't know this was PTA, outside of Daniel Day-Lewis even, because I'm not the biggest PTA fan. I think The Master is brilliant. There Will Be Blood's great. Punch Drunk Love's pretty great. Magnolia's pretty great. So, I mean, now that I think about it, he has had some pretty great things that he's directed in his repertoire, but there's not much about this movie that I watched the trailer and I was just kind of like, meh, okay. I don't know. It seemed like a very Oscar-y film.
Which is not what PTA does, which is why it feels weird.
Right. I mean, his films are known to push the boundaries. And
yeah,
not to say this movie isn't going to do that, but there are parts of this movie that feel very formulaic. Or at least how the trailer's cut. And I mean, that's us judging the entire movie based on a 2.5-minute trailer. But I mean, that being said, this movie, based on the trailer, feels formulaic. Yeah. And I don't remember getting that feeling ever from watching a PTA trailer. Like, I remember watching the trailer for The Master and being like, that's completely its own weird, intriguing thing.
Right.
And I didn't get that from this vibe. Now,
yeah, for something like The Master, you see that and you're like, no one has made this movie before. But right. You watch the Phantom Thread trailer and you're like, oh yeah, I've never watched this movie because I've seen a trailer like this 15 times and none of them look good.
Right. It seems to be one of those movies. I would be willing to bet this is a movie that is very divisive, but that everybody comes out of it saying Daniel Day-Lewis is, you know, mesmerizing and worth watching for him alone, which I could totally see, but for all we know, this movie is the runaway hit of the year, and the trailer is just trying to, you know, not give anything away and just, you know, put it on screen as saying, hey, PTA Daniel Day-Lewis, here you go.
Right.
And, you know, run from there. But it's just the feelings that we get from the trailer. Alrighty. Moving on to Only the Brave. That is our movie of the week. I don't even know if I said that at the top of the show or not. We're reviewing Only the Brave this week, a new film starring Josh Brolin, Miles Teller, James Badge Dale, Taylor Kitsch, Jennifer Connelly, Jeff Bridges, tons of people, tons of amazing people. It's directed by Joseph Kosinski, whose two other big films that he's directed to date are Tron Legacy and Oblivion. So not the greatest record. But this film is based on the true story of the Granite Mountain Hotshots, which are a elite group of firefighters. And as the plot description says, they risk everything to protect a town from a historic wildfire. For those of you who don't know this, it based on the true story, but it's based on the Yarnell Fire Hill Fire in Yarnell, Arizona, back in June of 2013. And it's a true story. And I read a couple articles and for the most part, it's pretty factually accurate, other than some parts where you could probably pick out that it's been upped for cinematic effect. But yeah, I think it's, from what I've read, and we'll get into this a little bit more later, it is a fairly accurate story. So, Trevor, what are your initial thoughts on Only the Brave?
I think it's a great story that didn't turn into a great movie.
Ooh!
I think the movie is okay. I think it's pretty good. I think it does a lot of things well. I think there's a few things that fall flat. The ending does not fall flat. I had tears streaming down my face. So, I mean, I wasn't like completely disconnected from this or anything. I just, looking back on it, I think it's a much better story than it was a movie. And I think, and we can kind of dig into this, but I think they tried to tell too much of a story in the time period. I think that's my biggest issue with it.
As in they tried to cram too much into the 2 hour movie time.
Right.
Okay.
Right. But I also want to say at the top that the acting in this is amazing. Everyone is great. Everyone is great.
Right. Okay. That's interesting that you say that because I 100% loved this movie. I think from the advertising of this movie, I was fully ready to go in there as this was going to be a very bro-merica movie, which in some parts it is, but it's so much more than that too. And it's because of the performances that are given on screen and because of the camaraderie that you feel between all of these actors. There's a certain weight that the actors have on screen. And I think it's in the respect that they are trying to give in portraying these brave men who are the real life people behind what they're playing on screen. This movie was incredibly emotional for me, but I think it's a powerful film that deserves to be seen by lots and lots of people. I think that it moves beyond that patriotic film in the way that I always want these films to do, because I feel like so many of these true life films that tell stories of heroic people like this rely on the patriotism to tell their story. But this movie, it gives you so much in the characters and helping you relate to them and get to know them as they go on this journey that it moves beyond that type of film and is just so incredibly powerful. It's, in my opinion, the best movies are the ones that make you think about your life. They make you respect life more, and they ultimately make you want to be a better person, whether that's, you know, you see a documentary and it's, you know, you want to take action after watching that documentary for injustices or because of being inspired by somebody. Or if you see a, you know, narrative movie such as this, it makes you look at your life and think about everything that you have in a way that, you know, makes you want to go home and hug your wife and son or call your family and, you know, tell them that you love them and that, you know, you're thankful for them. And ultimately, in my opinion, the best movies are the ones that have some sort of make you want to move in some sort of physical way. And this movie does that for me. I mean, this movie, getting out of it, I was floored with how much I liked it. And as I've said on the podcast many, many times, I'm a very emotionally attached person. And so, yes, my emotions probably got the better of me, but I don't even care, because I think this movie deserves that. And I think this movie does a great job with that story and being respectful to those people. The meat of the argument, though, with this movie, though, is going to be spoilery. And I want to go ahead and get into that, because now that you've said where you are at on the movie, I'm more curious than ever to actually talk to you about it and see where we differ on these thoughts. So,
yeah. If
you haven't seen this movie, go see Only the Brave. It came out last week, and it's out in theaters. I don't know if you're going to agree with this, Trevor. I think we would both recommend seeing it, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yeah. It's a good movie.
It's a good movie. It's not fun. That's a bad word. It's a movie. I'll explain why I was going to say fun in just a second. It's a movie that I think that you can take your family to in kind of a, maybe not like your 6 or 7 year old, but you know, teens and stuff like that,
and have a good conversation
with after.
Yeah, and it's not gonna traumatize people like Backdraft. No. It's not that kind of firefighter movie.
No, definitely not. But if you haven't seen it, go ahead and go see Only the Brave now in theaters. If you have seen it, then continue on with us as we jump into our spoiler discussion. So for those of you guys who have seen the movie and who, or haven't seen the movie, but know the story of the Granite Mountain Hotshots, the end of this movie ends with them dying on the mountain in a fire. 19 of the 20 Granite Mountain Hotshots lost their lives in the fire that day. And I mean, the second, I don't know what happened with you as you watched this movie, but I think the second, like, Trevor, you had texted me and Jake and been like, bring your tissues, boys. It's going to be a sad one. I didn't know the true story behind this, but I think in my head I was like, okay, so like Josh Brolin's character, Eric, the superintendent, is going to die, or Miles Teller is going to die, or Taylor Kish, like one or two of these guys are going to die. I didn't realize that it was 19 of the 20 men were going to lose their lives. And I think the second I realized that, and you know, you see that fire and you know they've prepped for this so many times as in the process of trying to become hotshots, I started crying immediately, and I don't think I stopped crying. That's like 10 minutes left in the movie. I don't think I stopped crying until I was about 5 minutes out from my house. And I mean, I cried for probably like 20 minutes straight. Just with this movie, even after I got out of the movie, I was so emotional after this. How did you take in the end of that movie?
Well, yeah, I didn't know that all of them died. I sort of had like a vague memory of hearing about this on the news when it happened. I knew that someone died. If someone always dies in firefighter movies, that's how it works. Which is, someone needs to make a happy firefighter movie. Maybe we should write one. but yeah, their death was, I mean, in the kind of 2 minutes before it, their death was foreshadowed. I think when the airplane mistakenly dumped on the fire that they were starting to stop the other one, that's when it kind of dawned on me that they were doomed, that was going to be it.
All of them, or just some of them?
Well, I knew that someone definitely was going to die at that point, the way that it was headed. There weren't tears coming out of my eyes. I was getting there until Donut walks in the middle school and everyone looks at him. And the way that people looked at him is not how anyone should ever have to be looked at.
No.
Ever. And then when he ran outside and screamed the "It should have been me, he was better than me," that's when I like totally lost it. I was totally done at that point. And then what? Something that made me mad about this movie is they didn't let you deal with that at all. That like happened, and then it was like roll credits tribute to the real guys. Like I need I need some kind of resolution here. Like I need something a little better.
But I think that they did give that to you. So to set up the end of the movie, he, as Trevor said, he goes outside. Jennifer Connelly's character, who's the wife of Eric Marsh, the superintendent, Josh Brolin's character, comes out and tells him that, you know, basically, you know, he was proud of you. He, you know, he wouldn't have switched spots. Like, I think that they, after that, they jump to, you know, 3 years later, and it's Miles Teller's Brendan Donut McDonough, and his daughter, 3 years grown up, at the tree that they initially saved in the fire in their hometown. And I think in that moment, at least for me, that was the time to process that and think back on those men in their lives.
I think I needed more time.
Yeah. It's incredibly emotional. And the scene where Miles Teller, so pretty much what happens is Miles Teller, earlier in the movie, he had gotten bit by a rattlesnake. And so they send him to go be a lookout for the fire as they're kind of around the corner trying to stop the fire by starting another fire so that they can, you know, not give it as much ammunition as it's coming towards them. And he's sitting there, and all of a sudden the fire picks up on him, and he doesn't have time to make it back to the group. And so another firefighter comes, picks him up, and then he's separated from the group. So 19 of the firefighters are one place, he's in another place. And he ends up being at this base camp as he is having to listen on the microphone to the medevac person coming in and saying that 19 firefighters are down. And that scene where he's in the bus just hearing that, I thought he did a masterful job in that scene. And yeah. I think it's a lot of people would be like, it's easy to just kind of, you know, let go and just like be angry, but it's like he does it with such like you really feel the weight of that scene in his performance. And I that's so powerful to be able to capture that raw anger and frustration in that moment. I think that's a job well done to Miles Teller.
Yes, I agree.
It's a powerful film. I mean, I think I am curious, and I tried to find a response. I haven't been able to find a response of any of the wives or families of the people of the Granite Mountain Hotshots. I haven't found any of their reactions online to the film. The Donut Brendan McDonough, Miles Teller's character, he put out a reaction online that said that he felt that it accurately portrayed the members of this crew. You know, that's good to know. Because in a movie like this, you always kind of are curious how accurate is this film to what really happened. And I found an article on USA Today that kind of puts that together. And so let's go through some of the false things. One of the false things is Jeff Bridges' character, who is kind of, as they say, fabricated slightly to be a mentor figure in the film. He's combines a couple of characters in real life into one character so that, you know, for a more cinematic feeling of making it more focused. One of the other things is how long the firefighters were together. It says that the Hotshots were together for longer, that the movie suggests the Hotshots were together for longer than they actually were. In reality, the turnover on the team, both before and after it was certified as a Hotshot crew, was frequent, as is the case with most Wildland crews. The movie paints it as a, like, this is a group of 20 core men who are together for life. And, you know, it kind of, that's not as true as it could be. Brendan McDonough wasn't bitten by a rattlesnake. And I think the last one is that not all of the, or there's two more. The personal conversations that happened before the fire of Eric Marsh and his wife about kind of having a kid, that's not necessarily 100% true. I think McDonough, Miles Teller's character, Donut, him talking about his future with Marsh wasn't 100% possible. I think in real life, it says that Marsh reacted to saying, whatever you need for your daughter, you go ahead and do that, and I fully support you. And so I think that was, you know, there's things that are played a little bit cinematically for the movie. And the last thing is the ending of Only the Brave, which is the movie depicts a dramatic sequence in which Donut has an appearance at the school without words to the horrified members that he was the only hotshot who was not lost in the fire. In reality, the wives and family members learned of the deaths more haphazardly through media or social media in some cases. At the time and to this day, family members say they were forced to go through the trauma in too public of a manner. And so I don't think that scene at like the school happened. I think it was more everybody kind of, or at least what I'm gaining from this article was that everybody kind of, you know, was by themselves in processing this. But other than that, everything seems to be pretty factually accurate. Other than the, you know, so one of the big questions in the real situation is how people, or how, what actually happened to the Granite Mountain hotshots, because so little is known in those last moments because of, you know, we don't have anybody who really knows what went on. And so a lot of it is based on what they can tell from the actual situation. So it's as accurate as to what they, based on their investigation, happened. Whether it's 100% true or not, nobody really knows. Okay, so let's talk. Are there any of those things, Trevor, that were a little bit shocking to you about whether they're factually inaccurate or accurate?
Not really. A lot of those things are kind of standard things that we get in based on a true story movies. With the kind of the combining of characters for efficiency and doing things a little bit for dramatic effect. I don't necessarily have a problem per se with any of those going the way that they did for this film.
Okay, so let's go ahead and get on to one of my favorite, or probably my favorite part of this movie, which is the acting performances that we get from everybody in this film. I have stated before, I'm not a huge Miles Teller fan. I think that he was great in Whiplash, and there's a couple of other things that he's okay in, but I'm not the biggest Miles Teller fan, but I think he's fantastic in this movie and perfectly portrays the character that he's set out to portray on screen.
Yeah, I agree. I think Teller was great. I was pleasantly surprised how great he was. I think the real star of this movie is the mustaches. I think that they kind of stole the show in some ways, especially Taylor Kitsch's mustache, which was amazing.
Alex Russell's mustache was pretty darn good.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, Kitsch was great. James Badge Dale was great. I thought Jennifer Connelly was fantastic. I thought Josh Brolin was really good. Maybe not great. I think he can do better. I think not that he was bad at all, but we've seen Josh Brolin do amazing things before. And I think it wasn't quite to his top, but I mean, as a whole, the acting was great. Jeff Bridges, has like nailed the like goofy old man role. He's done it in a few movies and it's like totally in his wheelhouse and it's fantastic.
And his Southern, I don't think he's from the South, but his Southern accent and the way that he plays that is perfect. So job well done, Josh, or Jeff Bridges. So I think this is one of Josh Brolin's better films. I think he channels the character on screen perfectly and plays it. You know, I think his anger is well channeled. I think his happiness, I mean, I thought he did a pretty great job. The biggest surprise to me in this movie, though, is Taylor Kitsch, who many of you know as Tim Riggins on the TV show Friday Night Lights. And he hasn't had the most illustrious movie career since Friday Night Lights has ended. I mean, he's been in some big things. Not many of them have been well received, but man, is he great in this movie. He was the shining star in this movie for me. And
yeah, I agree.
Go ahead.
I agree. This is definitely his best work since Friday Night Lights.
I don't know if it was the Tim Riggins fan in me coming out and just being like blind to anything else of any of his faults in this movie, but I was pretty happy with how he did in this movie. He initially starts out as like kind of the bully to Miles Teller's donut, as the guy on the team who's like, you're not going to make it, you're not good enough, and giving him a hard time constantly. And in the switch of a scene, they're best friends and roommates. And it's so like perfect how they portray it. And it doesn't feel fake. It feels like, oh, these guys have been through some stuff and now they're great friends. Like I was pretty surprised by how that turn went. Okay, so the relationship between Josh Brolin and Jennifer Connelly. I think this is the pretty powerful part of how they portrayed this relationship on screen. What did you think of their relationship on screen?
Oh yeah, I think it was great. I think it was one of my favorite parts of the film. I think it's one of it's probably the most interesting kind of character depth, from a character depth perspective, one of the most interesting subplots to the film. And they set it up so well from the beginning. Like, these are two people who are like incredibly strong-willed, incredibly tough, but they love each other so much. And you can see it in how they approach life. And not to over Friday Night Lights this thing, but it reminds me some of Coach and Tammy Taylor, mm-hmm. and their relationship, of where they're two people who may fight, but it always comes back to how much they love each other, and they're always able to sort it out because of that.
Yeah, exactly. I think you nailed it on the head when you said it's Coach Eric Taylor and Tammy Taylor and their relationship. And it's powerful and it's convincing and it's flawed, but you know, I don't think there's ever a point where you doubt that these two ultimately love each other and want nothing more than to be together. And that's incredibly powerful to get that on screen. So Trevor, what were some of the things about this movie that you felt fell short?
I think my biggest issue is that it somehow was too long and also should have been longer at the same time. And I think it's because nothing incredibly exciting or interesting happens to me, or to me anyway, until the very end. I think the first half of the movie is too fast. There's a stretch where we get like, I think 12 or something. I mean, I didn't count, but 8 or 12, like 2 minute or less scenes in a row, just boom, 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 boom. And everything is happening so quickly. We've got the time jumps. I think this story is better served as like a 10 episode miniseries in the vein of like Band of Brothers in the Pacific. I think that would allow you to dig into all of the characters, not just see some faces here and there. We kind of have a big setup with the guy who interviews right before Donut, but he like doesn't even have a line. I don't think until throughout the rest of the movie, he's barely kind of there. So I guess that's kind of my thing. I think that, there may have been a wider impact for the deaths of the characters, the impact they have while they were alive, if we knew a little bit more about them. We got the one scene where Donut is kind of freaking out about his daughter running a fever, and we get to kind of see these guys and their wives and what it's like to be at home and that kind of thing, and deal with that. But I feel like it almost was too long for what it ended up being, but the story itself deserved something a little bit longer to really weave all of these stories together.
See, I slightly disagree, because in a biopic, what I'm interested in knowing is who these people were deep down. I think that's what you're saying too, is that you want to know who these people are. And I think it gives us a good view of that in these moments when they're on the mountain. Because I think in those moments, at least from what I know, which is very limited, but you know, in times like that, you're ultimately going to know the true worth of a man, of how they react in those situations. And so I think, you know, you're getting the raw output of who those people are in those moments, how they react to those, how they help the person next to them, how they fight for the person on their left and their right. And I think that so much of a person can be told by how they're reacting in those moments. And so while they don't spend as much time with the characters at home, and they spend a lot more time actually out as a group, I think it's incredibly effective when it when they are all together. Now, I get that, you know, we really get to know 3-4 of these guys, and then somewhat have scenes with 5 others, and then there's probably 10 guys that are background people. And, you know, unfortunately, that's just the nature of a 2-hour biopic instead right. of a, like Trevor said, 10-episode miniseries. But I think for what it was, it did it incredibly well. Now, could we have gotten a little bit more in depth with who these people are? Yes. Would that have made things a little bit more impactful? Maybe. But I mean, at the end of the day, it still had an effect on me that
yeah,
I mean, 99% of the movies I see haven't had.
I think that if, I will say, if this had been a 10-episode miniseries, the ending would be like the gut punch of all gut punches.
Right.
If I mean, it would, I don't, it, now that I'm thinking about it, it might be emotionally overwhelming to end a miniseries like that.
Right. I think it's incredibly, I think the ending, if you even build it up even more, is just even more weighty. Because, you know, just from 2 hours, we feel like these characters are our friends. I mean, I think any of us could go in and be like, oh, I know a guy like Taylor Kitsch in this movie. Oh, I know a guy like Alex Russell's Andrew Ashcraft, or Scott Hayes' Clayton Whitehead, or, I mean, any of these guys. I think you could really kind of pick people out and be like, I know somebody like that guy or that guy, or, hey, those guys are my friends. I have friends like those guys. And that's ultimately the something that's great, is that, you know, you're able to pick out people that you know in this movie. But yeah, if it was 10 episodes, I think we would be on the floor as soon as it's done, just weeping.
Yeah. Yeah, you're probably right. So, I mean, I don't want to be misunderstood. I liked this movie, and this is a really good movie.
It's okay, Trevor. You don't like this movie. That's fine.
It's to me, it's not a great movie, but that doesn't even really matter that much, because it's a great story and it was told well. And right. That's really the most important part here. I usually say, and I've said this a few times on the podcast, but I always tell you that I'm not incredibly interested in biopics or based on a true story movies, because I'd rather watch a documentary or something like that. This is one where I think this works better than a documentary,
okay,
for telling this particular story.
See, and that's ultimately where I land. I don't know how much footage there is of these Green Mountain firefighters, but in order to have, you know, a documentary, you need footage. And I just,
right,
I don't feel like there would be that. And part of what I love about this movie is the cinematography. I think that it's incredibly well shot. I mean, I'm not going to go out there and be like, oh, it's Deacon's level of amazing, but there are some shots in there that are really cool. Like that shot of the deer running across the landscape, and then you kind of pan up and see the fire. I don't know how much of this is shot of real wildfires versus, you know, CG. From what I've read,
I've been trying to find out, and there's not a lot of info on that, at least that I could find.
Yeah, I watched a video called like the secret CGI of Only the Brave. And that makes me think that there's, you know, some of this that's CGI. Like obviously the trees falling off the ledge into the canyon, that's CGI. But I think it's a healthy blend of the two.
I'll say and they did this a lot, and I like the way they did it. But anytime they had the overhead shots of the hot shots walking through the forest, or while are hiking, all of those shots were beautiful. The directly overhead shots, and the way that the colors of their uniform and their helmet contrasted with the landscape around them, and the way they moved together, those were great shots.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. I think that's one of the skills that the movie does, is how they portray all of that. That's a great example of that. And there's multiple times where they have shots like that in the film. Okay. Last piece of talking on this movie is, do you trust Joseph Kosinski to direct the sequel to your most beloved film, Top Gun?
You know, it doesn't matter, because Top Gun Maverick is like the exhibit A of films that don't need to exist. Like, it's 35 years later. You can't be a fighter pilot when you're 55 years old. Like,
I think Tom Cruise begs to differ.
Well, yeah, but I don't know. I think he'll do a just fine job. What makes Top Gun work is that everyone buys into how ridiculous it is. And I think that Tom Cruise helps sell things like that because he's in all kinds of movies that are ridiculous that he makes work. So, I mean, it's going to be silly. It's going to be unnecessary, but yeah, I think Kaczynski can do a good job with it.
My biggest worry is that, you know, what you said of Top Gun is, you know, it doesn't take itself seriously, but a lot of Kaczynski's films, Tron Legacy, which I actually love Tron Legacy. I think it's a very underrated film. And
I agree. I think it's very good.
Yeah. Well, good. I'm glad that we can actually agree on that. I don't think Oblivion's great. But all of his films take themselves very seriously, which is sometimes okay. And sometimes in Oblivion's case, you know, if you have Tom Cruise on screen, let him have some fun. But this film, I feel like, works in comedy very well. Like, there are some comedic beats in this film that worked excellently for me and had me laughing pretty hard in the theaters. Trevor, any other thoughts on Only the Brave?
No, I think that pretty much sums it up. I will say my just to clarify, my complaints are simply about this film, not about the story or the subject matter. Nothing but respect for these guys who are wildland firefighters, because good Lord, what a job.
What a job these men have. And I had a conversation with my boss at work, and one of the things that we both just said was the bravery and courage that these men have is so above and beyond anything that I can even comprehend, because what they are physically capable of doing, of putting themselves in those places, I just can't even comprehend. And so hats off. I respect the heck out of those men. And I think this movie portrays that very effectively. So Trevor, what is your rating for this film?
All right. I'm going to give this, in honor of the Hot Shots basing out of station number 7, I'm going to give this a 5 out of 7. Five out of seven. I think it's a good movie. I had a few issues with it. It's definitely worth seeing. It's definitely a story that is worth telling and worth hearing.
I give this movie an A. This movie is a solid A for me. If we were to put out our top 10 films of the year, this would definitely be in my top 10 films. It emotionally brought me in like I haven't felt in a movie in a very long time. And I should say that even though I'm an emotionally attached person to a lot of movies, it takes a lot to make me cry. And I can't think of another movie that's ever made me cry harder than this movie. And, you know, a lot of that just had to do with the thoughts that it leaves you with at the end of this movie of, you know, family and respect for these men and the courage and bravery that they have. And like we just said, you know, I have nothing but respect and honor for these men. These are the type of movies that make me optimistic for people. This is the type of movie that, you know, you watch and you're like, there are good people out there who are willing to sacrifice everything so that people can just keep living their lives. And that makes me just proud of these men and makes me optimistic. And I think that this movie does what it needs to do very well, and it should be highly praised and sought after because of that. So this movie's an A for me. Solid A. Yeah, liked it a whole lot. But that is all we have for our review of Only the Brave. Highly recommend it. Please go see it. It's worth your time. And yeah, let's get on to our content of the week. Even though Jake couldn't be here with us tonight, we should say that Jake wanted to recommend the Steven Spielberg documentary that's on HBO. I think it's called Spielberg. And I've heard great things about it. Jake loves it. I've talked to him a little bit about it, and he highly recommends it. So Jake's recommend of the week is the Steven Spielberg documentary on HBO. If you have HBO Go or HBO, you can find it on there. Trevor, what is your recommend of the week?
All right, all of mine are a little bit sort of related to our movie this week. One is that Joseph Kaczynski directed a video game trailer for Gears of War that came out for the first Gears of War game that's called the Mad World trailer, because it has a version of the song Mad World by Tears for Fears in it. And this is the video game trailer that changed video game trailers forever. I don't know if you remember it, Cam. I think we were probably in high school when it came out, but it was a very quiet... it had a very strange feel to it, while also showing people destroying aliens or whatever the bad guys are in Gears of War. So that's, check that out. It's on YouTube. It's probably like a minute long. Go see it. To kind of follow the theme of civil servants, but in a completely different feel. I may have talked about this before, but the new season of Brooklyn Nine-Nine just started, and Brooklyn Nine-Nine is a great show. It was created by Mike Scurr, who's worked on The Office and Parks and Rec, of course, and The Good Place. It has Andy Samberg, but it's not Andy Samberg just being standard SNL Andy Samberg. There's a little more depth to him, a little bit more creativity. It's got Andre Brower being absurdly hilarious. It's Brooklyn Nine-Nine is great. My last thing is if you saw some of the landscape shots in Only the Brave, and you liked it, go visit Arizona or Utah or New Mexico, because it all looks like that and it's all beautiful. Get out there.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Okay, so I have kind of a, I don't know how I want to phrase this, but a, if you liked this actor in this movie, go see this movie. So, if you liked Josh Brolin, now is the time for me to remind you that No Country for Old Men is a real movie that is out, that is fantastic, and that I know people talk about it, but I don't think people talk about it enough for how great it is and how great Josh Brolin is in that movie. If you liked Miles Teller, go watch Whiplash. He's fantastic in that. Damien Chazelle, who directed La La Land, it's his first film, and it's one of my favorite, it's probably one of my top 25 favorite films of all time. Highly worth a watch. If you like Taylor Kitsch, Lone Survivor may be the only Taylor Kitsch movie that I can recommend. But it is extremely well done and is Peter Berg and Marky Mark at their best. And lastly, if you like Jennifer Connelly, I would highly recommend A Beautiful Mind, which she stars alongside Russell Crowe in that movie. She's also just a fantastic actress in numerous things. I mean, I don't know if I can recommend Requiem for a Dream, but that is one of those movies that it's like, okay, I saw it. I never want to see it again. You were great in it, but I, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. Definitely never want to see it again.
Yeah, exactly. She's a fantastic actress. Hope to see more of her because she did a great job in this movie. That is all that we have for this week on Popcorn Optional. If you have liked listening to us, please go to iTunes, subscribe to us on iTunes, leave us a review, let us know what you think. We would love to know what your thoughts are on the podcast, and so please interact with us on our Twitter at Popcorn Optional. You can email us or find more of our work at popcornoptional.com. We're also on Facebook at Popcorn Optional. My name is Cameron Salina, and you can find me online at 321 Cammy Time. Trevor, where can we find you online?
I am at TurboTrevor on Twitter and Instagram.
Jake Brown couldn't be with us tonight, but he's an incredibly talented filmmaker. You can find him on online at jakebrown.tv. That's all we have for this week. We will be back next week, hopefully with a review of Stranger Things 2, depending on how fast we can binge that show and how fast we can get through all 9 episodes of the second season. But until next week, pop, pop!